Good afternoon, and welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here live with you every Tuesday at 2, talking to you about healthcare and fitness trends, and taking your phone calls. Today's show is an interview with nutritionist and biochemist Dr. Luke Vucci, who is author of his new book, Healing Arthritis the Natural Way. This is published by Summit. He had a book previously that we discussed with him, also called Pain Free, which is also from the Summit Group. As usual, I will open up the phone lines for your participation. I'm not sure, again, I'm going to sort of judge it by how much material we're getting through, but roughly between 2:30 and 2:40, and I'll announce that when we're ready to go. The number to call us always is 510-848-4425, but please hold on until I open up the lines. I have a little editorial that I wanted to share with you that I found that was very much about what we're going to talk about today. It's an article from Physician Sports Medicine magazine called Decreased Mobility in the Elderly, the Exercise Anecdote. The two doctors are Buckwalter, M.D., and DeNouble, who is an editor for the magazine. Roughly, what they're discussing is not only that, as we've known before from previous studies, that exercise and weight resistance training works fabulously well in the elderly, and in addition, when bone is being lost, it will rebuild bone, and that increased muscularity, it's all these things about increasing mobility and also keeping people from falling because they're stronger and they have a better sense of balance because weight resistance training builds in proprioception, which is your balance. But what they found out is, on top of everything else, there are age-related changes in soft tissue function that occur partially because of systemic changes as we age, in circulation and hormone secretions, things like that. But what happens is it alters the way in which the capacity of bone and cartilage cells, the way in which they proliferate and grow. And because of this, there's a decline in the ability of these cells to perform their functions. So what they're saying is that, combined with the fact that aging muscles are more easily injured by their own contractions, and that doesn't mean you can't contract them, it means it takes them longer to recover. Because it takes longer to recover, sometimes this protracted healing extends the period of immobility if somebody gets hurt. So when somebody is older in their training, they may be sore longer or they may get injured in some way and it may take longer to heal. As a result, people sometimes stop training. Because of these changes in the joint structures, the articular cartilage, ligaments, and the synovium, which we'll all discuss today a little bit. The synovium is the fluid in the joints. It can lead to stiffness and limited range of motion. This also means there's an increased vulnerability to injury. And particularly in cartilage, which we'll be discussing today with Dr. Vucci, the chondrocyte, which are the builders of the, we'll discuss this, the chondrocytes are the ones that help to rebuild the cartilage, their function and their responsiveness to the stimuli is reduced. So people get stiff, they get tired, there's a decline in the cartilage strength. And what they've discovered through doing scientific studies, testing with control groups, is that regular joint loading and motion are necessary to maintain articular cartilage and the synovial joint range of motion, and it also to keep the process in the chondrocytes going, so you rebuild cartilage. Basically, to make it simple, what we're saying is that strength training has the most dramatic exercise benefits because it may forestall the declines in strength and muscle that occur with this process we've just described. In addition, when they've compared 68-year-old men who were engaged in 12 to 17 years of strength training with 28-year-old men who were active in various athletic pursuits, they found that that when they looked at their isometric strength, by looking at cross-sectional areas of their thighs and legs and elbows and flexor muscles, they were similar. So what we're really saying is that there's substantial benefits for strength training even into the, as they say in the article, the 10th decade of life, for those who live that long. It's pretty simple what they're saying. What they're saying is that on top of all the other benefits that we knew about, now what we're seeing is a specific benefit from weight resistance training for the elderly in protecting the joint structures and continuing to create an atmosphere or an environment for them to grow and to encourage growth in those areas. And that decreases the possibility of people becoming immobilized. It also recommends prudence, as I always do, with strength training. When I've worked with elderly adults, it's a good idea to start slowly, and attention has to be paid to how much mobility there is when you start, because you have to start where you are in both energy and strength and mobility, and that has to be observed. So people should work with people who are paying attention to how they move and how their structures are when they start. Prudence, as usual. All right, well, let me get my guest on the line, Dr. Bucci, with us. Are you there, Dr. Bucci?
Yes, I am.
Oh, goody. Let me introduce you. Dr. Bucci got his Ph.D., it says magna cum laude, in biomedical sciences from the University of Texas in Houston. He also has a bachelor's in chemistry from St. Edward's University in Austin. His postgraduate training was in experimental radiotherapy, which was done at one of the larger cancer hospitals in Houston. He's written a whole raft of journal and publication articles, including two industry books. And the book that I mentioned earlier, which we've discussed on the show a few, maybe a year ago or so, also on arthritis, called Pain Free, The Definitive Guide to Healing Arthritis, Low Back Pain, and Sports Injuries Through Nutrition and Supplements, by Summit. We are now going to discuss his newest book, which is called Healing Arthritis the Natural Way. And let's just get into it, shall we? You know, one of the things that we hear a lot is people often will complain that their injuries express themselves more in cool, damp weather. So I thought it might be interesting for you to talk about how it is that old injuries set the stage for the development of osteoarthritis, which is only one form of arthritis we'll discuss.
Okay, actually, that's probably one of the leading causes of osteoarthritis. It has been called the wear and tear hypothesis, but what most injuries do is they change the mechanical alignment of how the two opposing cartilage surfaces connect to each other when there's force on the joint, which is like standing up or walking or running. And if things are slightly out of balance or out of whack just a little bit, what you will do is cause excess pressure on certain areas inside of the joint. And what that will do is it'll make that little area what we call ischemic, which means a lack of oxygen and less than normal. It's literally being squeezed, and the fluid with the oxygen is being squeezed out of it. And the cells in there, the chondrocytes, they become oxygen deprived. And when that happens, you generate free radicals. It's kind of a rule of living beings here on Earth that if you have less oxygen than they want, you end up producing oxygen-derived free radicals. So what that will do is these free radicals are, of course, very reactive atoms and molecules. They literally start to tear up little molecular pieces of your cartilage, and they drift into the synovial fluid, and then they are picked up by the cells in the synovial lining. And what that does is it triggers a whole chain of events that involve all these little growth factors and hormones and immune system cells, and the end result is a long, slow progression of what we now call osteoarthritis.
You know, this is one of the reasons why I'm such a stickler on people learning some form of movement re-education along with exercise. When I work with people, what I really try to address is weaknesses in their postural muscles and training them from underlying muscles out. Because if you don't do this and people are moving in a bad posture, to put it really simply, they begin to put pressure on these joints, like physically a shoulder joint is an example. And it sounds like this sets you up for injury, even though you may be doing something good for yourself, like exercising.
Oh, exactly, and that's why we hear so much conflicting information in exercise. If you do it right, it is, like you said just now in the editorial, it's wonderful. And we know that you need movement in your joint to pump the synovial fluid into the cartilage to feed it and nourish it and help it repair. If you really don't use it, you do lose it, so to speak.
Yeah, but it's always a good idea to use it accurately, and that sometimes requires some education. Now, there's a whole sort of daunting array of other forms of arthritis. I'm always surprised at how many different forms of arthritis there are. The thing that's interesting are the forms of arthritis, including autoimmune, where the body is attacking its own tissues, and also the ones that are infectious from viral infections and bacteria. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this other sort of category.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's more commonly known as rheumatoid arthritis, but then there's a whole host of other names. And the underlying mechanism of all of those is that your own body's immune system starts attacking your cartilage for whatever reason. Whatever the trigger is, that gives it a different disease name. But the bottom line is that something tricks your immune system into thinking that your cartilage is, say, a giant bacteria or a bunch of food that doesn't belong there, whatever. And then it mounts a response, and part of that response is showering your cartilage with free radicals. That's one of the ways our immune system cells kill things. So again, I think we're seeing a unifying theory for arthritis, that sooner or later, whatever the different causes are, they all cause a little bit extra free radicals to form right there in the cartilage, damaging the little molecules, and then that starts off the whole process. The autoimmune types of arthritis are usually more severe, since the immune system is there churning out a lot of free radicals.
What's interesting is that a lot of the same supplements and nutrients that help with osteoarthritis also help with this. But just to belabor it, but there's in your book a description of a whole array of types of arthritic conditions that come out of, for instance, people with psoriasis sometimes develop a form of arthritis. People with Crohn's disease sometimes get an arthritis-like inflammation. There is, in fact, when there can be joint inflammation that's caused by parasitic infections and viruses and fungi and microbes and bacteria as well.
Oh, yes. This is well known in the medical literature. It is probably more common than doctors think, because it's sometimes very obvious. You go to a foreign country, you get some sort of traveler's diarrhea, and you also get very achy joints, and then it clears up and you get better. But then you later on, a few years later, have these nagging sore joints that come and go. So, in fact, Christopher Columbus seemed to have that problem when he came to the New World, so I think he's our first case of the Turistas. And he actually died from complications of Reiter's syndrome, which really afflicted him. So these things are probably more common than we suspect, because we're always exposed to these organisms. We've increased usage of antibiotics. We've made these germs a little more mean. We've also increased use of over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatory pain-killing drugs like ibuprofen and the host of imitators. They make your gut leaky and allow the bacteria that are always there to sneak through and get into the rest of your body. All it takes is one to get through the gut, to have your immune system get triggered into making antibodies and an immune response against that, and then you have the chance to cross-react to your joints, because the
right.
coating of these bacteria are molecularly very close to cartilage.
So one of the things we've started to talk about here is the downside of using pharmaceutical treatments that work more quickly than supplements and nutrients, but there are a whole list of drawbacks to both anti-inflammatory preparations and ibuprofen and aspirin and steroids.
Well, one thing that, the reason I wrote this book, since I already wrote the pain-free book, is to update things. And one of the things I wanted to point out is that there's been a lot of research going on that we're ignoring on these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, that they work on our hormones in the wrong way. For example, ibuprofen will knock out your nighttime production of melatonin.
Ooh.
And that has far-reaching implications. So you might not hurt, but sooner or later, if you keep taking more and more ibuprofen, you're going to wipe out your melatonin response, and that will mess up deep sleep patterns, which means you don't get as much growth hormone, which means that you don't have that repair stimulus naturally to all tissues, but especially joints. So there's a lot of far-reaching implications with these drugs that are just now being looked at. I'm trying to blow the whistle on that, because I think that long-term use of these things is not good. Short-term use, you feel fine, but let's not have people stay on these drugs for years.
Yeah, particularly the steroids do disrupt hormones quite a bit, actually.
Oh, that's so well known that I don't even talk about it much.
Yeah. For those of you who just dialed in, it's Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Dr. Luke Bucci, who is both a biochemist and a nutritionist, who has written a second book on healing arthritis using natural supplements and nutrients. And we've just been sort of talking about this, and we'll talk probably for another 15 or 20 minutes, and then we will open up phone lines. I'll warn you when that happens. So let's move on to what you call chondroprotective substances. And the first one that you begin to talk about in the book is the one that most of us know about now, partially because of your good work, which is glucosamine. Now, glucosamine first arrived in a sulfated form, and recently people have begun to recommend the hydrochloride. Why don't you explain why the hydrochloride, along with being slightly less expensive, might be preferable?
Okay. I think that's really the main reason is the cost, but also there is no salt or sodium or potassium with glucosamine hydrochloride. You know exactly what you're getting. And being inside the industry and knowing what raw materials are available, it depends on how you label a product. Sometimes it could be up to 50% salt and 50% glucosamine. What a lot of people do is buy cheaper glucosamine hydrochloride, mix some sodium sulfate salts with it, and say it, shake it up, the old shake and bake method we call it, and then say that it's glucosamine sulfate when it really is not. And that's where you get some of the glucosamine sulfate out there is like that. And if you don't know, you just don't know, unless you have very fancy, sophisticated laboratory testing, you don't know if you're getting the shake and bake glucosamine sulfate or the stuff that's used as a drug in Italy, which they don't let out very much here in this country. So that's why I am trying to blow the trumpet for glucosamine hydrochloride. It's made here in America. It's an intermediate for making tetracycline antibiotic, in fact, by drug companies. So it's quite pure, and it's in such large amounts that it's about one half to one third the cost of the glucosamine sulfate material. So both will work. I'm not saying that glucosamine sulfate is bad. It'll work just fine.
Well, but it may be a weaker form of glucosamine because it's cut with salt. And it also could be a problem for people with hypertension, no?
Yes, the people that are sodium sensitive, this might be a problem. And it depends what they cut it with. Some people even cut it with sodium chloride instead of sodium sulfate. They're really cheating, but that's not too common, fortunately. That's why I prefer to go with the glucosamine hydrochloride. You know what you're getting. You know that it works. And once you dig deep into the glucosamine sulfate literature, they actually used radioactive glucosamine hydrochloride to show where the glucosamine went for their glucosamine sulfate drug approval studies. So in other words, we know it works, regardless of what other people say.
Then we move on to chondroitin, which is in a sulfated form. Is that the only form it comes in? Should those people who are worried about salt now worry about the chondroitin sulfate?
No. Chondroitin sulfate, depending upon how it's extracted out of cartilage tissue, that's the only way to get it. It may or may not have sodium with it. Usually it's calcium. And that's usually a small amount anyway. So it doesn't have the same problem that glucosamine sulfate does. I like to think of the glucosamine as a pearl and the chondroitin sulfate as a strand of pearls. Or necklace.
So maybe we can backtrack for a second, because what we've just learned in your description is that chondroitin is a substance that it comes from cartilage.
Yes.
And glucosamine, because of the glucose in it, sounds like it has something to do with sugar. So maybe you can explain how they are, how they're different from each other and how they work differently from each other.
Yes. I'll go back to the beginning and make it quick. Glucosamine is made by the chondrocytes in cartilage and really all connective tissues, including bone. It's made from simple blood sugar, glucose, and one of the amino groups from the most common amino acid, glutamine. There's an enzyme called, of course, glucosamine synthetase that makes it. And that's really the key rate-limiting enzyme. In other words, that's where cartilage is either made or not made. And that enzyme gets highly regulated, and during arthritis, that enzyme is turned off practically so that you can't repair. And the body does that itself with these cytokines and immune system hormones. And the immune system itself will give the signals to stop producing cartilage so we can make sure there's no germs hiding around. We don't want to wall off potentially life-threatening infections. So that's how our immune system thinks, because we're still back in the caveman days, so to speak. So glucosamine is the beginning step to make any kind of connective tissue, but especially cartilage. And what it gets converted into is it's further modified, and then a sulfate group is added without sodium, and that gets strung together in big long chains that we call chondroitin sulfate. And those get stuck together into bigger molecular structures that are called proteoglycans, and those get stuck in between all the collagen protein tough fibers that give cartilage its shape. So the chondroitin sulfate, because of that sulfate, they hold water and they give cartilage its cushioning and resiliency properties.
Just so that we're also talking to the people who always secretly suspect that it must be possible to get everything from just your food, apparently it isn't really possible just by maybe boosting your intake of amino acids to get the glucosamine in or eating a bunch of cartilage. It doesn't quite work the same way.
No, for several reasons. One is that the in cartilage, the chondroitin sulfate becomes cross-linked to collagen. So that, in other words, we can't digest that to its smaller pieces. So just regular old cartilage, like shark fin soup, for example, is you don't get very much chondroitin sulfate out of it at all. And glucosamine is easily destroyed by heating. So if we cook anything, it's out of there. What we're trying to do here is feed the cells with exactly what they need without, and also bypassing the negative control over the production of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a back door to feed your chondrocytes so that they can rebuild and repair themselves.
A neat side effect of chondroitin sulfate is the effect it has on the heart, and we've been talking about the heart on this show. So what does it do for the heart?
Oh, boy, I might get a pipe bomb in the car for this, but I think that's a real sleeper, that the chondroitin sulfate itself actually is a failed blood thinner drug. And that's how it got started with arthritis, because they noticed people's joints got better. But they found Dr. Lester Morrison here in this country in the 70s. He did studies since the 40s on wound healing and found out that atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, can be thought of as a aberrant wound healing response. So he thought, hey, this stuff works on wound healing from surgery. Let's try it out on hardening of the arteries. So he finally did it in animals and actually got up to people. And he had 60 people in each of two groups that had heart disease documented, verified, either had a heart attack or some other form of it. And they knew they had hardening of the arteries. So he gave them 1.5 grams of chondroitin sulfate a day for about 6 years. Another group didn't get any, but both groups got regular medical care. Well, after that six-year period, 14 of the control group had died from heart disease-related events, where only one in the chondroitin sulfate group had died. And that doesn't take a genius to figure out which group you want to be in.
Mm.
So what is going on is that chondroitin sulfate is doing several things at once, which we find out from nutrients in general. They always do more than one thing. It's actually helping your arteries, which is a connective tissue, by the way, to repair themselves normally and get rid of the plaque. So they actually can reduce the plaque. You get improved heart function. And so it works in a whole different mechanism than trying to reduce cholesterol or get rid of cholesterol. Cholesterol is just an innocent bystander. It's the hormonal and molecular free radical control over that plaque building process that the chondroitin sulfate just soaks up a lot of the free radicals as well. It also controls the entry of the oxidized cholesterol into the artery cell. It prevents that. So it really helps clear things out of the bloodstream a little bit faster. And in fact, in Italy, they're using it as a drug to help people with senile dementia from hardening of the artery.
Wow.
Neck.
I think the initiated audience is used to hearing about antioxidants. When we've been talking about free radicals and the fact that antioxidants work well, which of the antioxidants work the most on protecting cartilage?
Well, vitamin C by far. And it is not only an antioxidant and can get into joints better than the others because of its water solubility, but it also is the only other thing we know of, other than glucosamine, that actually works in the DNA of the cells in cartilage to stimulate them to make more collagen, more chondroitin sulfate. So it's an extra nudge or push in the proper direction. So it's both a trigger to make more repair molecules as well as help reduce the free radicals inside the joint, too.
Well, why don't you tell us what the other ones that you recommend are?
Another one that's right behind vitamin C is vitamin E.
Mm-hmm.
There are some human studies with vitamin E. I think it's a criminal shame there's no studies with vitamin C in joints. Everything's pointing to it doing miracles almost, but nobody's studied it because nobody will make reap economic rewards, I think. But vitamin E has two studies, one in Israel, one in Germany, that showed in just a couple of weeks, which is really short, take 400 IUs, and you can actually cut your dosage of pain-killing medication in half. So for a short-term study, that's quite remarkable, and I think if you stick with it, you will tone down the pain from joint problems, as well as reducing the free radicals that are causing the whole problem. So my bottom line is that I think that the antioxidants are very good at helping to prevent arthritic conditions, especially if you do have an injury, a mechanical imbalance, or eat bad fats, which generate free radicals, by the way. So I think they're much better for prevention rather than treatment, although if the right studies were done, I bet we could treat arthritis successfully with high doses of vitamin C and moderate doses of vitamin E.
Since we mentioned good fats, vitamin E works synergistically with the essential fats, both the omega-3s, which we usually get from fish oils, and GLA, which is quite plentiful in borage and primrose oils. So those are also highly recommended, huh?
Yes, and I think they're even more useful in the rheumatoid or autoimmune types of arthritis. For osteoarthritis, there's better ways to fix the joints, but for the immune system component, they really do make a difference. They have been medically tested, and if they had actually controlled the subject diets, I think they would have worked even better than the successes they did find. They're slow-acting, but they do tone down the inflammation and damage to the joint so that you can then go back in, use the chondroitin and the glucosamine things to help rebuild the joint. And with the vitamin E, keeps your essential fatty acids from breaking down the cells, as well as converting the enzymes, or how should I say, is protecting the enzymes that make your good prostaglandins from the omega-3s. So there's a lot of mechanisms these things are helpful.
We're going to take a very brief musical break, about 30 seconds. I'm going to come back with Dr. Bucci, and we'll talk for another 10 minutes or so before opening up the phone lines. We'll come back and talk about some more vitamins and minerals and move on to hormones. This is Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman with your own health and fitness. I'm talking with Dr. Luke Bucci, biochemical nutritionist and author of Healing Arthritis, The Natural Way. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman on the phone with Dr. Luke Bucci, biochemist and nutritionist, author of his newest book on chondroprotective nutrients called Healing Arthritis, The Natural Way, published by the Summit Group. And we've been talking about quite a number of things. We talked a considerable amount about glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, and we've moved on to vitamins and minerals. Minerals, of course, are quite important, calcium and magnesium. And, you know, I must say that I keep seeing sort of slightly cutting-edge things that say that calcium and magnesium should be in equal amounts if people, you know, tolerate it, if their intestinal function tolerates it. What do you think about that?
Oh, I'm all for it. I think that we're way too hung up on too much calcium.
Yeah.
And I guess I look at the rest of the world, and you find that most other people's don't get very much calcium in their diet, maybe 200 to 400 milligrams a day, which is less than Americans do, yet they have much less osteoporosis. And you have to ask yourself, you know, why? If they don't get much calcium and don't have osteoporosis, we're missing something here. And what we're missing are the other minerals that help build bone, like magnesium, zinc, manganese, copper, boron, silicon, et cetera, et cetera. And I look at it like a chain. Of course, we all know a chain is only as strong as the weakest link. And it just so happens that in this chain, let's say there's 100 links, well, maybe 70 of them are calcium, and 20 are magnesium, and 5 manganese, and 4 zinc, or 1 boron. But if So if you are deficient in any one of those minerals, it's going to break the chain. And you can pour calcium in, mm-hmm. and it still doesn't make the chain stronger.
Right. That's a great way of putting it. The way I've been trying to discuss it with people is that these things work like instruments in an orchestra, and they all have to be there. And if you get too much of one, it throws, too much, I think it's calcium, throws off, makes you lose makes you lose zinc, or, I mean, there's a whole delicate balance to these. So that's important.
You're absolutely right, and what I've also uncovered is that the people that get osteoporosis most are the people that drink the most milk. So wait a minute, what's going on here? Milk is calcium and builds bones, right? Well, when you're growing, yes, but it's more than just calcium.
Yeah, it has to be balanced. There is something about fibromyalgia and magnesium. I've known some people who've been treated for fibromyalgia. Who were tested and found low in magnesium, and they were actually given shots of magnesium, which reduced their symptoms, which is pretty exciting stuff. You mention a little extra little thing that nobody knew about, which is the carpal tunnel and vitamin B6 connection, and cautions about B6. So let's have those.
Well, yeah, that's actually been studied, and we now know that about one-third of people with what is diagnosed as carpal tunnel syndrome, all they need is maybe 100 milligrams of B6 a day for a few months, and they're fine. Sometimes if you add vitamin B2 at 25 milligrams at a time, that's only as much as the body can absorb at once, that speeds up the process. And some people are now looking at magnesium added to that, but we don't have studies yet. But the toxicity limits are about 200 milligrams of B6 a day. You start going over that, and you may end up with B6 deficiency symptoms from an excess of B6. So that's because B6 needs to be in an activated form to work on enzymes in our body. And if you give the regular B6, which is not activated, it will crowd out your activated B6 and the enzyme, and you end up with a B6 deficiency.
I have to move on to hormones because I just love talking about hormones. I was interested to note that while you talk about DHEA and pregnenolone, or pregnenolone, depending how you like to pronounce it, and melatonin, you didn't talk about the bone protective effects of estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. Is that because everybody kind of knows that now? Or?
Well, it's a good reason. It's such a big story, I didn't want to just give the highlights. I wanted to, how should I say it?
You got another book cooking?
Well, the other people have done it very well.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
And I don't really have to do that. But I didn't want to get into that one because it is a big topic, and I think it really merits a lot more time than I can give it in my book. And you're right, though. I think that we are going to see these what we call the sex steroids, the testosterones and estrogens and progesterones, being used for bone especially. And I really wanted to focus more on the joints than the bones themselves.
Okay. Now, DHEA is really interesting, except that one of the things that people find, particularly women, and of course being a woman, I have that, I'm sort of more sympathetic, or it seems to be more easily tolerated by men than women because men can tolerate a higher level. They have naturally a higher level of DHEA. But what I've noticed is with women is that it will often sort of go, we don't know which direction DHEA is going to go in. So it seems to go more toward androgens in women. And my concern is that when it goes to testosterone, it sometimes goes to estrogen. And then it can throw the balance off of estrogen and progesterone. I also wanted to caution people who may be taking thyroid medication. If you try DHEA, you have to try a minuscule amount. Maybe start with only 2 milligrams or something, because it will potentiate the activity of the thyroid med.
Yes, and I'd like to, I've tried to stress this in my book, and I'd like to stress this in general with DHEA, to get tested first.
Thank you.
Not everybody is that deficient, and you do have the potential for throwing things off. The more you take, the more potential, and although it does appear to be relatively quite safe, there's still some unanswered questions long term. So if you get tested, well, in other words, what I'm trying to say is if you're deficient in DHEA, the supplementation really makes a big difference. If you're not deficient, it won't do anything, so why bother?
Well, it can make you feel sort of weird, is what I've noted with people. Pregnenolone is interesting and very unknown at this point, sort of a feel-good neurotransmitter, happy sort of substance. I have a friend who I've had on the show, Dr. David Zava, over at Aaron Labs, who does the saliva assays, who's noted in his own practice that People who are taking pregnenolone, not always, but sometimes have lower levels of DHEA in response, and when they go off the pregnenolone, after several months, their DHEA levels go back up. What do you make of that?
Oh, that kind of makes sense, because that what that means is that you're probably activating alternate pathways of producing the hormone downstream from DHEA, so your body doesn't need to make as much DHEA. So it's probably a normal adaptation that people have. These people have other pathways that do not go through DHEA, that start off with pregnenolone. So that's
So what you're saying is maybe So if people are a little low in DHEA, if they start taking pregnenolone and their DHEA levels drop on paper, mm-hmm. what you're saying is maybe, in fact, it's still being produced.
Right. DHEA has its own effect, but it also is an intermediate in production of other things. You want to look at all the hormones, not...
Yeah. It's just funny that it would be lower in saliva test. Anyway, it's an interesting little thing. I think there's so much we don't know about pregnenolone. It's sort of an interesting substance. Melatonin. I always wonder whether if people take melatonin regularly, whether the pineal gland will just say, oh, I don't need to do anything.
So far, we don't think so. It doesn't appear to shut down endogenous production, in other words.
Mm.
Don't have definitive answers, but it does appear to not down-regulate your own production. Now, I wish I could be 100% certain, but so far it doesn't look like it's going to do it like taking anabolic steroids does to testosterone, for example.
And melatonin may be contraindicated in autoimmune cases, too.
Yes, that's because it actually helps stimulate or enhance the immune system. So it's thought that if you, we don't want to stimulate the immune system when it's already attacking itself.
Yeah.
But what we're finding out in most real-life anecdotal cases is that actually it's being aided. It's kind of normalizing the immune system instead of just a priori boosting it, which is the nice thing about nutrients compared to drugs. Drugs will do their thing no matter what the situation is, where nutrients tend to bring up deficiencies or pull down excesses rather than just automatically stimulate something unless you go to huge excesses.
So we're basically saying that DHEA, pregnenolone, and melatonin may help joint structures too, huh?
Yes. They're normally part of our control mechanisms to keep joints healthy. The DHEA is a balance to your corticosteroids, the prednisone and things. And in that respect, it's very important for joints, especially if people are on those kinds of medications or under stress or diseases where your corticosteroids are always elevated. So again, you don't want to overdo DHEA, but you'd want to make sure that you have that balance between DHEA and cortisol.
Yeah, okay. And those are little items that your adrenal glands produce. The last thing I wanted to mention, and, I really like your work, but there was one little thing in the book that red flagged for me, and I wanted to bring it up. We recently did a show with Mary Enig, who is a very long-time lipid researcher. She's been at it for quite a long time. She's pretty well known. And we were talking about the beneficial effect of saturated fat in the diet. Now, I know that the bulk of what's being sort of expressed in the traditional medical community is to stay away from saturated fat, and she has, we've sort of already gone over this on the show, so I don't want to belabor it, but I called her because you mentioned this study in your book about saturated fat causing osteoarthritis.
Oh, yeah.
And we pulled the study
mm-hmm.
and looked at it. And first of all, one thing is that she was curious, too. So she ran a search, and it was the only thing she found about saturated fat being contraindicated for osteoarthritis. That's what we found anyway. But the other thing that's interesting about the study is what they used is they used pork fat.
Right.
And lard is only 40% saturated fat, apparently, talking to her. We're talking to the expert here on fat. The other thing that may be a little odd about the study is that you don't know when they do this whether the fat is rancid. There's a whole thing with fat. Fat is very delicate. And so there's a lot we don't know about how they did this study. So I just am not sure that it's that black and white, that saturated fat is always bad and that vegetable oils are always good. Certainly vegetable oils that are heated produce free radicals, so prudence is always a good idea. But I'm not sure that any fat is completely bad. It's more a question of how fat is handled and how it's eaten and the fact that it's protected.
I couldn't agree more with you. I think you hit the nail on the head. This was a spontaneously arthritic breed of mice. They just develop it all by itself, so we know that there's something different about them anyway. But you're right. They use lard, which we already know is rancid, and it's not the saturated fat in animal fat that's bad. It's the rancid arachidonic acid that generates all these really messed up prostaglandins that are even more pro-inflammatory than the normal ones made from arachidonic acid.
And I think it's important to remember that even the so-called bad arachidonic acid or the bad prostaglandins are there for a reason.
It's essential.
Yeah, and that cholesterol even in our bodies is there as a protective mechanism. So, okay, well, that wasn't so hard.
No, I'm appreciating that one. And I wish I could explain things in more detail, but sometimes editors wield the knife.
I had a funny feeling about that. Well, you know what? I think our callers are interested in getting in with us. This is, we're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness, and I'm talking with a biochemist and nutritionist, Dr. Luke Bucci, about his newest book called Healing Arthritis the Natural Way. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. We're going to go ahead now and open up the phone lines to those of you who want to join us. The number is 510-848-4425. Again, it's 510-848-4425. You can join us now. And please remember, before you are picked up, to turn your radio down so we don't get a feedback. I think we have a caller. I have Cleo, I think, on in Oakland waiting to get on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks for an excellent program. You mentioned about minerals. How does one make sure one is getting all of those minerals and in the proper proportions?
Very good question. You want to eat as many fruits and vegetables and whole grains as possible. That's where we get most of our minerals from. You could always try a multiple mineral supplement, not a multivitamin mineral, because you'd never get enough calcium, magnesium, usually, but just a multiple mineral to add to your diet, not rely upon it, but that will most often than not boost your intake up to sufficient levels. Then there's the absorption and uptake issues that need to be dealt with, but intake of minerals usually fixes those problems. So it is very difficult, and I think that's the biggest problem with our diets are the mineral deficiencies, not the vitamins.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask him something on your behalf.
Yeah.
Do you have a way that you like to see people test for minerals in their bodies?
Well,
do you like hair analysis? What do you like?
Well, part of my background was 2.5 years as laboratory director for SpectraCell Labs in Houston, where
we did
a very advanced test of nutrient need on lymphocytes, and we only had tests developed for calcium, magnesium, and zinc. And what we found is that a lot of people were deficient and didn't realize it in spite of their intake. So there's other factors that determine how your cells use the minerals.
Right.
It's not just how much is there, it's how they're being used. Mm-hmm. So as far as a surefire test, to be real honest, I don't like the ones we have. Just measuring how much is there, whether it's hair or serum or urine or cells, it only gives you part of the picture. I think if you want to do it right, you have to measure hair mineral tests. You have to measure simultaneously serum, red cells, white blood cells, and urine, and that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on. And that's for the few functional tests, one of which is the SpectraCell lab test. But any test by itself is not going to give you the whole picture with minerals, and that's part of the reason they've been kind of ignored in medical practices and in health in general, because we do not have good tests of sufficiency or deficiency of minerals, all of them.
Okay, so balance.
No,
that's okay. Cleo, did you have one other quick thing?
Are those colloidal minerals a better absorbable way to get minerals?
If you like to get tons of aluminum, take
Thank you. Thank you. I was waiting for that.
Okay. Gotcha.
So,
all right.
I don't take them myself.
No, it's too dangerous. Mm-hmm. Cleo, thank you. We've got
to
move
you,
on.
Bye.
Let's get Nadja in Berkeley on.
Hi. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
My question is about glucosamine. I've been taking N-acetylglucosamine because I heard it was good for the joints and the intestines, and I want to find out is that the same as the other kind of glucosamines, and if not, is it better or not better than the other kind?
Oh, okay. No, it is glucosamine. It is, in fact, what I like to call activated glucosamine. But what N-acetylglucosamine does is that since it's already one step past plain old glucosamine, it turns out that your gut and your liver and other cells in the body will use it to add on to proteins. Your gut will use it to make mucus, for example. So in that respect, it's probably better for people that need to heal their gut, which is also made of connective tissue. And less of it gets to joints, so you have to take a somewhat higher dosage, but it will still work in the joints according to some animal studies we have. But it is more expensive. So in other words, yes, it will work fine. You need to take a little more, and it probably will work better for your gut and liver than just plain old glucosamine hydrochloride or sulfate. But it will be a little bit more costly. So it will work.
Okay, Nadja?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Let's move on to Mark in Palo Alto.
Hi. I was wondering if there were any known adverse interactions between common blood pressure medications and any of the arthritis remedies that you've mentioned on the program so far.
Okay, that has been looked at in the European drug approval trials, and they did not find any interactions with blood pressure medications for glucosamine sulfate and even the chondroitin sulfates, which actually have been used injectably in Europe for a couple decades. So those two we know are safe. Now, vitamin C, I think, doesn't have any direct interactions, but it may have its own blood pressure lowering properties in some people just by improving health in general. So you do want to keep an eye on your blood pressure, make sure it doesn't get low if you're on high doses of any antioxidant for that matter.
Okay.
But otherwise, no specific adverse interactions.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye.
Let's move on to Ray in San Francisco.
You know, one thing I was wondering if you might have run into in your research on this, Dr. Bucci?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, how do we spell that when we look for your
publication?
Good point.
B-U-C-C-I, like Gucci with a B.
Okay, thank you. Now, you know, some time ago, some people did some research, notably John Ott, on the interaction of sunlight with the endocrine system and the importance of unbroken direct sunlight on healing arthritis. Do you know anything on that?
I've read some of the literature on that, but I'm not real familiar with it, to be honest.
So it isn't to say that this is currently something that that you see in the literature very much.
Not in the peer-reviewed medical scientific literature very much, but it doesn't mean it doesn't work either.
Could it have something to do with the way vitamin D and calcium interact? You know, the fact that you need a little bit of sun to get that whole thing to function properly, to absorb the calcium properly with the vitamin D?
I think that's one mechanism. Another might be melatonin, which helps. If you can straighten out your melatonin peaks via sunlight at the right time, which would make melatonin come out at the same time as growth hormone and accentuate your growth hormone. Growth hormone is very reparative, especially the joint. So that might be another way it can work.
So taking naps is really good, because if you exercise and then take a nap later in the day, your growth hormone levels will go up real fast. It's the best way to get your growth hormone level to go up.
You know, in the case of that particular book that I mentioned, I'll cite it a little bit more accurately. It's John Ott, Light and Health, I believe is the title. It may be Health and Light. But one thing I would suggest is that if you do look for it in your library, that you try to get the hardcover edition, which has the pictures, because I believe the paperback editions were published without, and they are demonstrative of the injury to lab animals from the absence of natural sunlight, or the exposure to ongoing fluorescent light. In this case, it was lab rats whose tails were injured and which fell off when they were exposed over a long period of time to
Bad when you get them working in those offices, those rats working at the computers with the fluorescence. It's really nasty. Ray, thank you. Let's move on to Carol in Cupertino.
Hi. I have a question. I have tendonitis. This sounds really interesting. I'm also in the process of trying to get pregnant, and I was wondering if there's any problem with taking any of these things that you're suggesting, like glucosamine, in early pregnancy or later pregnancy, when you don't know you're pregnant yet, for instance.
Don't know if there's any adverse effect. I mean, obviously, your body's making lots of these things all the time, and in fact, your uterus and cervix actually increase production of glucosamine and chondroitin as they are remodeling and changing their shape and size. We do not know what would happen to the fetus since its skeleton is mostly cartilage, which means chondroitin sulfate. For safety's sake, I would say let's not do it or not go very high on it, because we simply just don't know. Don't suspect anything bad, but I'd rather play safe.
Not take it. It's interesting you say that because I was pregnant in the past. Unfortunately, it was a miscarriage, but my symptoms went away for the first time in years while I was pregnant, and they said it might have to do with some of what you're talking about.
Well, and progesterone also.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it progesterone. Was the progesterone in high doses that counteracts the corticosteroids and allows your body to repair.
So it sounds like I'll wait till everything. So after having a baby and then maybe try this stuff. But it sounds wonderful. How does it work with tendinitis?
I think the chondroitin sulfate is actually a little bit better for the tendinitis since the chondroitin sulfate has more anti-inflammatory properties that glucosamine doesn't have.
Okay.
And also from personal experience in playing with these things and minor injuries in myself and others, I think the chondroitin sulfate does a little better, but you need to go about 2,000 milligrams a day or so.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Carol, thank you. Luke, just before we move to the next caller, why don't you remind us of what kind of dosages people should start with and maintain with on these substances, glucosamine and chondroitin?
Well, that's one thing I see people make big mistakes, and they say, I've been taking this stuff and it's not helping. They say, how much are you taking? Oh, one pill every other day. It's like, oh, no. The glucosamine, the scientific data tells us that 1,500 milligrams per day has been associated with all those nice improvements in regeneration of joints. I like to go to 2,000 a day since Americans are usually a little bit bigger and more impatient. And the same amount of chondroitin sulfate, I think that you do get to better results if you go a little bit higher, but you do get to law of diminishing return. So 2,000 milligrams of each, glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, I think is a effective dose for just about everybody, and you get results usually within the first 2 months. And for vitamin C,
but just on those, let me just quickly. Then you cut back to a maintenance dose.
Yes, that is right. When you start to feel better and your joint function is better, then you can start cutting down. And that cutting down is going to be different for everybody, so we can't give hard fast rules, but everybody does have to experiment with that.
Now, you mentioned that taking it twice a day is ideal, a morning and evening, and I've noticed that a lot of the vitamin companies are selling them in a 1,000-milligram capsule. Would you suggest when someone's on a maintenance dose that they split the capsule and take it morning and night instead of taking it all at once?
Oh, no, I think just once a day in a maintenance kind of mode is okay.
Oh, that's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
all right,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's get very quickly Mike from San Francisco on the line. It'll probably have to be our last caller.
Yes, hi, Elena. I think I may have missed it on this program, but you've talked in the past about the advantages of papaya extract.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. That it was one of my questions, so I apologize. Yes, enzymes are very powerful. Luke, why don't you tell us about enzymes?
Oh, boy. Yeah, the whole chapter in the book, though, if I don't say it here, you can read more about it, but we have enzymes that chew up proteins in all of our cells. They're everywhere. They control healing and control inflammation and control production of our joints and other tissues. So all we're doing is when you have inflammation, the circulation around that area is impaired, and you don't have enough of these enzymes that degrade or chew up protein to speed up the process. So when you add them from exogenous sources like papaya or bromelain from pineapple, and now we have a lot of these fungal proteases that are very similar to bromelain, what you're doing is just supplementing the body's normal levels of protease enzymes, and you can actually enhance the healing process if you take the enzymes on an empty stomach every 4 to 6 hours, because they get in fast and go out fast. So that's the catch. And these things used to be prescription drugs in the 60s before they invented things like ibuprofen, which were much better at killing pain, but they don't do anything for healing. The enzymes are healing. They are associated with the healing process. That's how your body heals. So that I think they are very useful for acute traumatic kinds of injuries. In other words, if you play sports and get a bruise or a sprain, they really can cut the healing time in half.
It was my understanding that they were being used in Europe to break down buildup of...
You know what, guys? I'm sorry, but we're completely out of time. Thank you for bringing that up, though, Mike. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Luke, this has, as usual, been a wonderful show. You're so clear. It's so pleasant to interview you. You're so good about giving out information. Luke Abucci's book is Healing Arthritis the Natural Way, and it's published by the Summit Group. It's a paperback. You should be able to get your bookstores to order it. Again, thank you so much, Luke.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be in your show again, Lena.
Such a pleasure, yeah. All right, thank you to those of you who participated in the show, and thank you to Jan Michaels for engineering the show today. If some of you missed portions of today's show and you want to get a tape copy, a cassette tape of this show or any other show of your own health and fitness, you can call my office, please, during normal business hours. That's 707. This is also, if you need to get hold of me, you can call me there too. 707-769-1458. Again, 707-769-1458. For a list of other available shows, send me a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope with two stamps on it to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Next week, I'll be back with one of my monthly solo shows. In this one, I will try to address the issue of how to protect your heart naturally, sort of a follow-up to last week's show about heart disease. So please don't miss that next week. I'm Lena Berman. This has been your own health and fitness talk show on KPFA 94.1 FM. See you next week.